A Life in Laughter, Cafe Conversations with Madeline Smith. In Conversation with Bill Lawrence, Episode 5.
In this conversation, Maddie set the record straight about her iconic appearance in that James Bond film.
Guess what? My telephone number at home at that time was Richmond, R-I-C, Rick, 2007. I've never made much of that, but, you know, it occurs to me from time to time, and I think, is that weird or is that weird?
So tell us first, how you got the part?
Okay. I think it was American money. Not too sure about that. But Pinewood, the previous year, had a wonderful telly series on film made at Pinewood, and it was called The Persuaders, and it was Tony Curtis and Roger Moore. And I think they were ridiculous stories. Mine was even more ridiculous than most, I think. Anushka Hempel and I were pretending to be somebody else. Ridiculous scene, utterly delightful. Thought Roger Moore was heaven. Tony Curtis, oh boy, could have died for Tony Curtis at that time. Any time, actually. And Roger directed this episode of The Persuaders. And suddenly, within a month or two, I'm being offered a part in Roger's first Bond film. I'm his first Bond girl. As Eunice Gayson, I think I'm right, was Sean Connery's first Bond girl, so I was Roger's first. What I'm not implying is that he was a virgin and I was his first.
So you knew Roger well, which must have helped.
No, Bill, I didn't know Roger well, but I had adored him and loved working with him and thoroughly enjoyed it. And so one January morning, I find myself back at Pinewood, in bed with him, actually. It's a strange thing. But showbiz is odd.
So I'm sure you've told this story many times before. In this film, he's got a magic watch, hasn't he?
He has.
Produced by the British MI5 or MI6, I'm not sure. But it has the ability to magnetically undo zips.
Yes, and all sorts of other things. It appears several times
I'm
in the
film.
I'm
sure this isn't a real watch, is it? There must have been some way in which they faked this. How did they do this?
Yes. Well, they didn't actually do anything to the watch itself, but down my back was chicken wire, fish wire, gardening wire. I have no idea what kind of wire down this hideous dress. And it had all been laid on by the special effects guy. And come filming the scene where Roger is unzipping my dress, basically, I've been in bed with him, romping, rolling around very innocently. Well, not plot-wise, not, but in real life, very innocently. And I sneak off and sneak into the cupboard and pop me frock on. He comes along when Em and Moneypenny have gone. He comes along and wants to unzip it with his magic watch. However, this dress was very thick, and the magic, whatever it is, wire that's down the dress that is supposed to be being pulled from underneath to make it appear as though it's sliding down, it wouldn't go, would it? So I have it on good authority, which is Roger's actual diary, that three people were under my knickers.
It's not often you can say that.
No, I don't often say that, and I'm not sure I've put it that way before, but it happens to be the truth. One was a wardrobe lady, one was a very young boy, and one was the special effects guy, Derek Meddings. And Ian, who was the young boy, who is now a distinguished older gentleman, I actually met him again a couple of years ago, and I said, well, very nice to see you, because, of course, I hadn't really seen very much of him before, as he was under my frock. But anyway, it's absolutely true. One of them was pulling on the dress, and one of them, or two of them were pulling on the dress, and one of them was pulling on the zip. And finally, it came down wonderfully smoothly, and the scene was shot. But that's ruined the film for anybody that sees it now, Bill. But the funny thing is, I knew the film was already finished and they were going to be just doing these little catch-up shots with me. I didn't know how significant the scene was. I had no idea how it was going to be knitted together. I just knew that I had a little teeny-weeny part as a spy and that it could easily be cut out anyway. These things happen, I'm afraid. It's funny. I wasn't overwhelmed. I was very excited and delighted, but I wasn't overwhelmed. It was so friendly, and Guy Hamilton, who directed it, was such a sweetie. He was like everybody's favourite uncle. And Saltzman and Broccoli were miles away, probably holidaying somewhere or in the cutting room. I have no idea. I never met them. And Roger was such a poppet. It was really only Roger, the director, the cameraman, and me, or that's how it seemed. We were in a corner of the studio, absolutely freezing cold studio, in a little tight corner. And it's really odd, isn't it? But I wasn't overwhelmed at all. I just had a ball. The joke is, of course, that his wife Louisa was at the bottom of the bed watching. And apparently, according to Jane Seymour, she did that with her as well. So, yeah. Don't know why. I have no idea why she was so odd about that. No, it's strange, isn't it? Looking back, I think I had such a lovely time in my career that I never, in film or television, suffered from nerves. The nerves were in the theatre.
And in this conversation, Maddie talked about her career move onto the West End stage.
You must have enjoyed that whole process, very different from what you've done, working with a small group of people for a year,
yes.
Every day for
yes.
a year,
yes.
Small group of people on stage,
yes.
Small group of people backstage.
Yes.
So that process was something that you thrived on.
You had to do a year in those days. There was no 3 months or no 12 weeks or anything like that, like actors insist on now. It was a year. And I can remember once meeting dear Richard Briers in the underpass. He was at the Criterion and I was at the Lyric Theatre. And I looked at him and he looked at me and he said he'd had enough. Because in those days you had to do a year. I think that was Funny Person Peculiar or a name like that. It was an Akeborn he was doing. It was incredibly funny and he was absolutely wonderful. And I think that his play is the one that led to The Good Life. I'm sure he was spotted in that. And I think that turned into The Good Life. Well, mine didn't turn into anything, but I was in a play with Alec Guinness called Habeas Corpus, written by Alan Bennett. And it was absolutely wonderful. It was almost like a long poem. Brilliant piece. Very much in the imagination. Patricia Hayes was... she played the cleaning lady, but she was the voice of reason. And whenever anything was happening on the stage between, say, Alec Guinness and his wife Margaret Courtney, or me, or any other character, Roddy Ward Roxby, Andrew Sachs, little Patricia would come on in the background as the little cleaning lady. And she'd appear with her face round the flats and say, "Oover, oover, oover." And she'd be listening there, bless her heart. She was totally wonderful. She had just been in a teleplay called Edna the Inebriate.
Yes.
I'm not the vagrant. I'm not the vagrant.
She was a wonderful character actress.
Yes, wonderful.
And what was she like though as a person?
Wonderful. I became best friends with her.
Did you?
Patricia. 100%. Totally genuine best friend. I adopted Patricia and she adopted me. And we used to go off to the Swiss Centre and have cakes and tea and things together. And Patricia was in real life a genuine eccentric. She would go and raid Berwick Street Market's, you know, rotten box. She'd come in with rotten fruit. She'd go through dustbins and pinch old telephones, anything. She always drove, so her little car was always stuffed full with goodies that she'd take home. She had doggies, and she had enough to feed them from the dustbins.
She was before her time, wasn't she?
Oh,
She'd be one of today's reusers, recyclers, wouldn't she?
Absolutely right.
What's Sir Alec Guinness like to work with?
He was a very fine company leader, but he used to, indulge his appetites for food. He adored food, by inviting people out for supper singularly. Mm. So he would invite out Andrew or John Bird, who was in it, or Roddy, or myself and Patricia. The wonderful Phyllida Law, who Emma Thompson's mum. He would invite you out singularly. He wasn't very good in a crowd. He liked confabs. He liked people in groups. And he loved gossiping. He would sit at the side of the stage gossiping away, sometimes quite cruelly. He had quite a sardonic wit. You might not always like what you heard, but it was all in good spirits, really. I have to tell you one thing. One night, Patricia Hayes, who definitely in real life was wondrously eccentric, came on in a new hat, a new cleaning lady's hat, bright green, not even lettuce green. It was bright emerald green. And she came on, and it looked like a lettuce sitting on top of her head. And he went absolutely berserk. He went completely nuts. And he had to hold back afterwards in his anger with Patricia. And another night, I'd obviously had garlic, probably smell of it now. I'd had garlic the night before, and he danced all over the stage, literally all over in my scene with him. He's meant to be kissing my knee in the scene. And instead of kissing my knee, suddenly like a little leprechaun, he's over here, or he's over here, or he's over here. And he kept whispering, "Garlic, garlic." So he was an imp, was Alec. And he was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant.
So you must...
Essentially, it's a poem.
Yeah.
It's Peer Gynt. It's Ibsen. It's a poem. It's about life and death, but done in the vein of a seaside postcard. It was actually a very complex play. A lot of people didn't understand it. And when we were on tour with it, Alec nearly walked out because he thought the audience didn't like it and didn't understand it. Anthony Marriott wrote a play not dissimilar at all to No Sex, Please, We're British with John Chapman about 10 years, I would say, after No Sex, Please, We're British, and called it Shut Your Eyes and Think of England. But he created the role and was magnificent in it. He turned a very lumpen play into a vehicle for himself.
And it's a bit of a farce, was it?
It was a bad farce, but Sindon, on the first night... Talk about Arthur Lowe. On the first night, Sindon absolutely came to life. He started all this business with a telephone, dropping bits of the phone, and he literally created the comedy on the first night. It had lumped along throughout rehearsals and throughout the tour. It was absolutely dreadful. Dreadful. Really bad. And it had Frank Thornton in it, and a very nice lady called Jan Holden playing Donald Sindon's wife. But Sindon, absolutely brilliant. I had a terrible part in that, and it was as a result of my boredom in that I decided, right, that's it, I'm going to go back to school, I'm going to take myself through my English again, which I did all on my own, and got taken on at Goldsmiths. It was then that I decided I am bored out of my knickers. I did my growing up while I was acting, and that's actually true. I also did a lot of training. I went to RADA for some classes, and I also went to the City Lit every weekend for classes. So while I was learning by doing it, I was also training, because all of those teachers were RADA teachers.
And you were also increasing, yet again, your compendium of experiences, because you started doing children's television for the BBC.
Loved it. Absolutely loved
it. What was that programme called?
Well, there were two different series. The first one was called The Deceivers and was about con men. And the second, we made several series called Eureka, about inventions. All of them written and directed and produced by the genius that is a guy called Clive Doig, who's really been with the BBC for many, many years. An amazing man, absolutely amazing. Still an amazing man. I wish he was still doing it. But he's 80 years old now, he's probably had enough. But wonderful, 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 wonderful stuff. Each week, the same little company of actors getting together, acting out these scenes, especially for children.
Yeah.
And just making them lively, knowledgeable, funny, amazing stuff. The Deceivers we recorded in Manchester, and that was about naughty con men, and Eureka about, say, for example, the history of the dishwasher, or Monopoly, the game of Monopoly, counting, all sorts. And at the same time, of course, the very final series that we did, I was actually taking my finals at Goldsmiths, London University. My English degree was actually, and Clive actually had my schedule, all my exams, throughout, not only recording it, but rehearsing. So, my head was in 100 different places.
Now, that's the end of series one of the podcast. There's always series two to come, Maddie.
My goodness, Bill, you're a hard taskmaster.
Thanks very much, Maddie.
That was episode 5 of A Life in Laughter with Madeline Smith.